Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. 50 years ago this summer, white volunteers flooded Mississippi to register black voters. It's known as Freedom Summer. It's remembered, of course, for the murder of three civil rights workers. Our guest, Peniel Joseph, says that summer is also historic because it marks a turning point in the civil rights movement. It's also the subject of a great piece he wrote, I think for the Sunday New York Times, it was Sunday, entitled When Civil Rights Unity Fractured. Peniel is the founding director of the Center for the Study of Race and Democracy at Tufts and the author of Stokely, A Life. Peniel, it's great to see you.
Hey, great to be back.
Well, you have written a great piece about how white Americans that went down to Mississippi and black Americans who were there or came down view this totally differently. So tell us about Freedom Summer and people's different perspective on it.
Well, yeah, Freedom Summer, we call it Freedom Summer now, but it was started out as SNCC's summer project, a student nonviolent coordinating committee. And the aim was to bring over 1,000 white volunteers to really try to have an experiment in interracial democracy in the state of Mississippi. So they were going to be teachers, they were going to be canvassers, they were going to offer free legal services, at times health care services as well, try to register people to vote. So Freedom Summer was very, very much one of the most important events of the civil rights movement's heroic period. And when we think about how blacks and whites viewed it differently, white Freedom Summer volunteers, many of them, so this is different from hardcore white activists who stayed in the movement,
yes,
people like Tom Hayden. For many of them, it was going to be the first and last time they were ever involved in civil rights activity. So it's a high point. Many wrote memoirs. There's over a dozen white Freedom Summer memoirs.
Really?
Yeah, and some even admitted that they had been a little too arrogant. There was one guy talks about being there, and he had sort of the wrong attitude. And years later, he says, well, you know, he learned more from the people than he taught them. But for the most part, they were liberals, they were progressives. This becomes a high point in their whole conception of the movement, more than the March on Washington. When it comes to black activists who are part of it, it's different because they looked upon Freedom Summer as something that showed them the price of freedom and citizenship in the United States, and that small d democracy could not be mediated through the Democratic Party.
And ultimately, it ends up, speaking of the Democratic Party, we'll get to this in a couple of minutes, it ends up at the Democratic Convention where all the hope of the Freedom Summer ends up collapsing.
And we should elaborate why that happened, too, and how that happened.
Well, let's get to the convention in a second. If James Earl Cheney, Andrew Goodman, and Mickey Schwerner had not been killed in Mississippi that summer, which caused everybody's eyes to turn there, how would this be remembered differently, or would it be just a footnote were it not for that event, which virtually, you know, while you're thinking about this, we have actually a news report from 64 when the three of them went missing. You probably know their bodies weren't found for 44 days. They were shot at close range by members of the KKK. Just listen to this news report.
There are 2.5 million acres of woods and big swamp in Mississippi. This is Boca Chica, one of the biggest and deadliest of the swamps. 100 men are picking their way through it today, looking for Cheney, Goodman, and Schwerner. But the plain fact is that 1,000 men might not disclose whatever secrets lie under the green slime of Boca Chica. This is Backwoods, Mississippi, silent and suspicious.
Well, that's a great news report.
Yeah.
So what is the answer to my question, Peniel? How would the whole summer and the whole series of events leading up to Atlantic City and the convention be viewed differently were it not for this unbelievably high-profile murder of two whites and a black?
I think historians would remember it as a very important event and very important summer. I think the American public would have less of a memory of it. So the importance of Cheney, Schwerner, and Goodman is that they riveted the country. They riveted Lyndon Johnson to send the FBI. Mickey Schwerner's widow visits Lyndon Johnson. We have great tape in the recent documentary Freedom Summer where Lyndon Johnson's talking to Director Hoover, FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover, and saying he just got visited by the widow and she was really ugly and mean to him. And because she was demanding that President Johnson send agents to find her husband and to find Cheney and Goodman. And so what's interesting about it is that those deaths really make the summer iconic. But the two other most important aspects are the Freedom Schools and the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party.
Well, tell us about both.
So the Freedom Schools, there's 41 Freedom Schools that teach over 2,000 students, 175 teachers, including many of them are white teachers in over 21 different communities in the South. And they're teaching them more than just reading, writing, arithmetic. They're teaching them about citizenship and telling these are poor black people. These are many black people to tell our audience who would never have certificates of birth or death certificates in places like the Mississippi Delta. And this is real. This is America in 1964. Many of them are sharecroppers picking cotton, right? Telling them that they are citizens of this great nation as well, that they are Americans, that democracy applies to them, and that they can get the right to vote, but also the right for political, social power in the United States. Really,
when you say those
stuff,
words and you realize this is only 50 years ago, do you not say to yourself how surreal it is?
Yeah.
It was not 250 years ago. It was 50 years ago. These kids have to be told that they have rights as citizens of their country. I mean, it's stunning.
Oh, and absolutely. And in small places and hamlets that they lived, they really didn't have those rights, right? They lived in constant fear. Stokely Carmichael said they faced raw terror where they went to Mississippi. Economic reprisals, all these things. Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party is hugely important. This was the independent party that tried to replace the regular Mississippi Party, which was an all-white party. So this was an interracial party. There's going to be about 68 delegates, four of whom are white. And what's interesting about Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party, it's led by sharecroppers. Fannie Lou Hamer, who has the riveting testimony before the Credentials Committee, maybe August 22nd, 1964, where she says, "Is this America?"
In Atlantic City.
In Atlantic
City.
At the
convention.
She says, "Is this America, the land of the free, the home of the brave, where we are beaten for wanting to live lives like decent human beings?" Incredible. One of the most moving things you'll ever see.
Well, let's not leave her for a minute, because she had an incredible story, Fannie Lou Hamer. Tell people about her biography.
Well, she was from Ruleville, Mississippi. She was 42 years old when SNCC, Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, found her in Ruleville in 1962, encouraged her to vote and try to register to vote, get involved in the movement. She does, and she's immediately kicked off of her plantation that her family had lived in for decades and decades.
She loses her home.
She loses her home.
And her job.
She's going to be beaten in Winona, Mississippi, both beaten by law enforcement, but also by black prisoners that law enforcement forced to beat her. So she goes through an extraordinary, she dies at the age of maybe 60 in 1977, dies prematurely. Incredible, intelligent woman who was not formally educated, but becomes the face of the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party. Lyndon Johnson is so terrified at her Credentials Committee testimony that's live that he interrupts it with a press conference where he basically says nothing. The interesting thing about that is that the press actually replays her Credentials Committee testimony for the next several days, and it becomes iconic. And remember those lines, "Is this America?" Because Fannie Lou Hamer had been trying to organize people to vote and had experienced the reprisals that many Americans hadn't. And really one of the most important aspects of this is the fact that bringing all those white students down, many who were not just college students, but they were the sons and daughters of, let's face it, important people, they went back and told the truth about what was going on in Mississippi. Some of them, like Mario Savio, was a Berkeley student, mm-hmm. and he's inspired to really start the free speech movement. He talks about that at Berkeley because of his time in Mississippi.
We're talking to Peniel Josephs from Tufts University's most recent book, Stokely Alive. Speaking of Stokely Alive, how old was he? 22 at this stage?
23
years
summer.
Old. Yeah. Okay, and I know people are sick of me saying this is beautifully portrayed, this convention thing, and all the way, the Bryan Cranston thing about LBJ. Just really.
That is brilliant.
I know, but I say it all the time. ART. That's where I saw it. I know, and I mention it all the time. I mean, it is just. It's chilling, and it was perfect.
Absolutely.
So they're rebuffed. I mean, they after this Freedom Summer and registration, they want their party, which actually represents the people of Mississippi as opposed to the whites of Mississippi. They're offered a deal, a pretty crappy deal. What happens with that? And then what's the fallout from
it? And the interesting thing is some really very good white liberals offer them that deal. It's people like Hubert Humphrey.
And I'm saying on behalf of the president, right?
On behalf of the president, people were very good on race matters, but here faltered. Hubert Humphrey, Walter Mondale, two non-voting seats at the Democratic convention, but not to be the official delegation, even though they followed the rules and the white regulars didn't. The reason why Johnson wants this, he doesn't want Mississippi to walk out, and he doesn't want the South to walk out and embarrass him on his coronation. The president was very sensitive. The interesting thing is with this new Freedom Summer documentary, we see the president talking about perhaps resigning and not running in 64 if this convention goes away, right? So this is before the basic abdication in 68. So when we think about the deal they were offered, the deal was not even just a compromise. It was a betrayal of the one person, one vote principle, which is the bedrock of our democracy.
And where's King on this deal, Martin Luther King?
You know, King is ambivalent. King is saying, well, you know, I understand why they want you to take the deal, but I can see why you wouldn't take the deal after all the experiences you've been through. Bayard Rustin, who's the organizer of the March on Washington, wants them to take the deal. And many of them, including Mendy Samstein, who's, you know, Jewish SNCC organizer, one of Stokely Carmichael's favorites, famously yells and screams at Bayard Rustin in a meeting that you're a traitor, Bayard.
The image is just, it's surreal.
Yeah, and so what's interesting is, so when we think about the white students in Freedom Summer, we're not talking about the hardcore activists. We're talking about volunteers who, they did 2 months of activism that was incredibly, 2 or 3 months of activism, heroic, incredibly important, but many of them saw the culmination of Freedom Summer much differently from the people who stayed and endured.
Well, there's a certain the white people come in to rescue people overtone to a lot of this stuff too, which I think
Have to live with the consequences.
Yeah, I mean, it's your son or daughter from someplace up in the Northeast, and you can go back to your home. You're not going to have to stay there and face all these repercussions. But before we get off the things you talk about the whole summer itself, give people a picture of what was going on there. We talked about Fannie Lou losing her job and being thrown off, losing her home, but there was tremendous violence that summer.
Oh yeah, there's tremendous violence. I mean, the day to day was trying to organize sharecroppers in the rurals and just black folks in the rurals, telling them that they had the right to vote, trying to make them understand that even though there was fear of reprisals, they really should vote and be part of this movement. There were freedom schools, there were community centers, there were free libraries, there were book giveaways, there were food giveaways, but there was also organized racial terror and violence against demonstrators, against the summer volunteers. The state of Mississippi purchased a tank in response to the Freedom Summer volunteers coming. They purchased guns and many arms. The rumor they set out in Mississippi was to say that Freedom Summer volunteers had been promised $10 a week and all the sex they could handle.
Oh, gee.
You know, Peniel Joseph, when you wrote this piece, again, when civil rights unity fractured in the Sunday New York Times, which people should Google and read if they haven't already, you didn't write this just as a history lesson of what happened 50 years ago, but contend that many of the lessons of 1964 have percolated into 2014 world. Tell us what some of those, how does that era manifest itself now?
I think when we think about biracial coalitions and how do we sort of renew those coalitions, in a way, the Obama coalition, especially the white and blacks who are members of that, are a great example. You can have whites who are progressive liberals, certainly anti-racist. They might look at the Tea Party or look at some of the opposition against Obama and say, well, you know, this is more issue-based than some racial problem, right? Blacks are looking at the same transcript, same resume, same event and say, well, no, this is unfettered racism. So part of it becomes blacks and whites, a lot of times, even if they're trying to converge on a specific issue, they see the issue from different perspectives. The same thing. They've seen the same thing. And whites see it one way and blacks see it another.
Does that matter? Why does it matter? If it turns out the goal is arguably the same, or at least close to the same, why does it matter if blacks and whites in 2014 approach the same issue, whether it's Barack Obama or immigration reform or anything else? Why does it matter that they come at it from different places? Or does it matter?
Well, I think on some levels, if the goal is the same, you can make an argument that it doesn't matter. But I think seeing things differently a lot of times make the goal different, right? So if we think of something like racism or poverty in the United States, if we think of it, or even sexism, as something that's systemic, that's something that's endemic, if one person looks at it that way, but the other person says, well, you know, I don't think this is endemic. I think that these institutions are sort of impersonal and don't get it. They definitely end up mistreating women and blacks and gays and minorities and poor people. But I don't think they want to do it. Those are two different perspectives, because the solution both of those perspectives are going to have are going to be much different than if we both say either one, hey, these institutions don't mean to discriminate, they just happen to, and we both agree on that. Or we say these institutions are actually systematically discriminating. The solutions we're going to come up with are going to be much different depending on that perspective.
When you see things like the Supreme Court rejecting, what was it? Is it Article 5 of the Voting Rights Act? Whatever the key provision pre-approval mm-hmm. provision, which was declared unconstitutional. What do you say to yourself as an historian, like you are, of this period? Like in 1964, and then there's progress. Can you imagine saying 48, 50 years later, there's going to be a Supreme Court of the United States that says that we don't need that sort of provision, despite the fact that, that racial bias in elections still is so dramatic?
Yeah, I think that that's a great example of the kind of, not necessarily cynicism, but the sobering reality that black activists took from Freedom Summer, that they were going to have to fight every inch of the way. And at times, these institutions that they thought they were going to, hey, if we play by the rules, the Democrats are going to let us in, that that's not necessarily the case.
Well, you know where I also think it's so, you see it so importantly today is in the media. You know, I've been a reporter most of my life and covered a lot of crime. And I said this to Jim before you came in, you go out to the crime scene and it, most everybody there is black. And most all the reporters are white, and most of the cops are white, and most of the firefighters are white, and you just can't help be struck by this. And I told this story to Jim, but I'll tell it again. I remember covering this case of this kid that got killed, and the mother really wanted to move because she had other children and she was scared to death. And she said to me, you know, you're going to go home to your house in Brookline, which is mostly white, and the Mayor Menino, he's going to go home, and the cops are going to go home, and everybody's going to go home, and I'm going to be stuck here with my other children and a son who was murdered for doing nothing wrong. And you just thought, it's easy in a way for you would see a whole different portrayal, I think, of inner city violence and inner city schools being underfunded and all these things if 90% of the people that were covering it were not white people that didn't live there. That I think that's a big deal in the media.
Well, yeah, and I think the what's interesting about Freedom Summer, when you think about media depictions of Freedom Summer, is so many white people actually did get a chance to basically they were embedded in the South.
Yeah.
One of the interesting aspects when you see the interviews and the documentary footage, this was the first time many whites had ever lived with blacks, and for the black indigenous people in Mississippi, that they had white people living in their house every single day, sleeping in their same accommodations. Even to a fault, because you had white segregationists saying, don't tell me that no sex is happening there where they're sleeping. Because that was a big part of the summer.
That's what they were thinking about, Peniel.
They were really thinking about that, right? And so embedding themselves in that, you had black people, survivors of Freedom Summer, saying, once those white people stayed with us every day, it did transform their thinking.
Yeah.
And so it was transformative, like living and working with black people, especially poor black people, but also the volunteers in SNCC were well-educated, really changed these white people. And I think for the better. They had a much different perspective.
Walk a mile.
Yeah. They had a much different perspective on race matters than they ever would have. And some of that continued where some of them became, whether they were in business or educators or whatever, they really held the Freedom Summer experience with them.
There you go. Walk a mile in the shoes, Jim. That's the motto, right?
Yeah, but the problem, as you say, is you get to walk home at the end of walking the mile, and that's where the divide, I guess, occurs. Your piece was great in the Sunday Times. Again, it's called When Civil Rights Unity Fractured. Your book, Stokely, which we've talked about, Life, is spectacular, too. I hope people read it.
Oh, thank you.
Peniel, it's great to see you.
Peniel Joseph is the founding director of the Center for the Study of Race and Democracy at Tufts University. His most recent book is Stokely, A Life, of course, about the great Stokely Carmichael. Peniel Joseph, thanks again for being with us. And thank you all for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Tune in tomorrow for some of our best interviews. Errol Morris talks about his new documentary about Donald Rumsfeld. We talked to John Waters about his latest book, which documents his hitchhiking travels across the country. Our show is a production of WGBH Boston Public Radio. Our production team, Chelsea Murs, Will Roselip, Amanda McGowan, John Parker is our engineer, and Devin Karambalis is our intern.
Yo, I'm laughing here. I'm not
laughing
because of what you just said. I'm laughing because we go from headlock and wedlock to Freedom Summer. I mean, it's a rather surreal juxtaposition.
The documentary is fantastic,
oh,
too.
My God.
Anyway, thanks you guys for listening. I am Marjorie Egan.
And I'm Jim Browdy.
Please tune in again tomorrow, and thanks for listening today.